Welcome to the webinar entitled Power, Access, and Representation in America's Tribal, State, and Federal Sovereign, sponsored by the League of Women Voters, Santa Fe County. My name is Debbie Helper, and I'll be moderating this session along with my co-moderator, Stephanie Schlanger. Our speaker today is Elizabeth Reese, Assistant Professor of Law at the Stanford Law School. She's a scholar of American Indian tribal law, federal Indian law, and constitutional law, focusing on the intersection of identity, race, citizenship, and government structure. Her scholarship examines the way government structure, citizen identity, and history that is taught in schools can impact the rights and powers of oppressed racial minorities within American law. Professor Reese is a graduate of Harvard Law School, where she was awarded her JD, Cambridge University, where she was awarded a Master in Philosophy, and Yale University, where she received her bachelor's degree. She began her career as a civil rights litigator at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, where she led a desegregation case in one of the largest school districts in Florida, and also worked on the challenge to Alabama's voter ID law. Welcome, Professor Reese.
Thank you so much. And thank you all so much for having me. I'll first introduce myself in my traditional language. So Navitoa Hawaiianpovi na Owinge Nambe Weangu Omu. So the translation of that is my name, or really what the people call me. Is Yompovi, which is my Tewa name. It translates to willow flower. I am from Nambe Pueblo. And I really, first of all, just wanna thank you all for inviting me and for taking interest in me and my work. So when I got the invitation from the League of Women Voters of Santa Fe, it was particularly exciting for a couple of reasons. The first reason was, it immediately just got me thinking about home. I'm from New Mexico, and so, and just north of Santa Fe. And so I was immediately thinking, oh, green chili, this time of year, and I got really excited. I obviously wish that this pandemic we're not wearing on so that I could be there with many of you who are in Santa Fe and, probably eating green chili. I would be eating green chili like crazy, I promise. So there was that reason. But the other thing that was really interesting and exciting to me about getting this invitation was that it gets at bits of both my work and also my intersectional identity that I often don't get a chance to talk about. I get a fair amount of invitations to talk about tribal law or to talk just, about Indian stuff, but not a lot about either things that touch on my gender identity, being a woman, or the work that I have done in voting law and voting rights as well. So it sort of felt like this was something that, tied all of those things together in a way that is rare, but also exciting for me. That also meant that I had this sense of, oh God, what could I say? what could I say that could do all of those different things that, I care about, but also are me, and my work, justice. And so what I thought I would do was actually just start with, a more personal note about how I came to do this kind of work and research into voting rights across the United States, and also into sort of breaking the boundaries of, frankly, ignorance between a lot of the different groups within the United States, but also, as I've come to realize, different governments within the United States. And so I'm going to start off by just telling this story. So, you know, I'm a Native American woman. I'm from a small reservation just north of Santa Fe, New Mexico. For those of you who are from New Mexico, I was born at St. Vincent's Hospital, just at the north end of town. My family has lived on the Nambe Pueblo land for at least 1,000 years. So my mom and I were probably the first people to ever move off the reservation, or what is now a reservation, but you know, what has just been our homeland forever, when she went away to grad school when I was a kid. You know, I very much grew up in this sort of bubble of Indianness, both on Nambe Pueblo's land. You know, all of my friends were just my family, or extended members of the tribe. And that world of, you know, the holidays that dominated our calendar was what was normal to me. When we would go into Santa Fe, we would do Indian things and participate in the other Indian spaces that exist there. I know lots of people who worked at the Indian school, for example, or at, you know, various Indian arts centers, or at the Indian hospital, right? So there was so much about even Santa Fe, you know, a place that I, you know, grew up in that I didn't really know about, because of the different boundaries and bubbles that existed. And so it wasn't actually until I went to college that I realized this even. I was invited to see, I was back in Santa Fe for an internship. I was working for the New Mexico State Historian's Office in Santa Fe. And there was I went to Yale for undergrad, and there was a like Bulldogs in Santa Fe event. And it was at someone's house, an older alum. And, you know, I tell you when, like, there's for those of you who are local, there's this street called Paseo del Peralta that kind of circles most of downtown, or the old downtown. And then off of that street, you can kind of make a right at some point, and it'll take you on this road called Bishop's Lodge that kind of bypasses the highway going north. And it's this beautiful scenic drive. And I've taken it several times to, you know, bypass the highway. Sometimes it's just change things up. But I never realized that off of that road, there are all of these other roads that lead to these beautiful, really expensive houses, like up in the mountains. Like, I felt like I was, you know, going into another world, like realizing that this entire area, neighborhoods, you know, like existed, and, you know, walking into this big, beautiful home, and also being told, I think the host bragged a bit about the adobe bricks used to construct parts of it. And I was, you know, this is the building material that my, you know, ancestors have been using for 1,000 years. And that to me, adobe bricks means grandpa's waking me up early in the morning to do like hard labor work, right? Not like, ooh, fancy fancy architectural detail. So, it was just like bizarre. It was bizarre for me. And I realized, I think then, that not only was there a boundary in place, obviously, that, you know, there these spaces, even in my hometown, were segregated. And there was huge economic divides between people, but that there were also just cultural divides that were really very real, in terms of lived experiences. And one of the things that I think about and also try to write about in my work is the way in which those things are not just empty things, but in fact, very real things that are a part of what shapes things, even like the law. So for example, when I, you know, then found myself as a litigator for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, I was doing a voter ID case. And one of the things I quickly realized there was that much of the law that that voter ID and a lot of voting cases turn on has to do with these questions of, you know, access to the ballot and sort of what is fair versus what is burdensome on individual voters. And I think as much as we would like those questions to be decided in a purely neutral fashion, they're incredibly subjective in a lot of cases. So, you know, it really matters who those judges are, who's deciding that case, looking at this evidence, whether or not they really think that it's actually prohibitively expensive and or just incredibly difficult for segments of the population to go through these, you know, hoops that the government has set in order to get an ID, get documents in order, whether or not, you know, they know people who, you know, like I do, were born with midwives instead of, you know, of course you have a birth certificate. You were born in a hospital. And so one thing that that I think is very much about sort of power in this country still and influences voting as well, is also culture and norms and the exposure that we also have to each other. So what I realized as well was that there was a lot of people in this country that do not know very much about Native people and who we are in a very real and contemporary way, and also what tribal governments are and how they function. And that ignorance, you know, not intentional or not, in large parts, this, what I like to say is that lack of knowledge about tribal governments or Native people isn't something I'm trying to point out to make anyone feel bad. Like it's just something I want to say, like, it's got an ugly history that, you know, this didn't happen by accident. There are very strategic reasons why, as a part of the process of colonizing, the tribes in the United States, or really the pre-colonial governments that were occupying this territory, it would be very effective to make them look small, to delegitimize a lot of what they were doing and sort of push it to the side, make it look unimportant, or to just make it kind of irrelevant or invisible. You know, that's a project that makes a lot of sense when you are the conquering nation trying to assert authority over the same land. So, you know, that's an ugly history. It explains a lot of the contemporary invisibility of Native people and of tribal governments. But, you know, we don't have to be owned by that now. We can, you know, do better and learn more across these different boundaries about what's, you know, well, who everybody really is and what's working and what's not. So, you know, with that, a bit on some of the things that I think tribal governments have been doing that I think are particularly interesting, exciting, and that interact with some of the things that people like yourselves who work on voting might care about. So those of you who don't know a lot about Indian law or tribal governments, I will give like a tiny little law professor mini lecture, which is that there are 500 plus tribal governments within the United States right now that are federally recognized. What that means is that the federal government recognizes them as having this status that we call domestic dependent nationhood. So a good way to think about it is that tribes are somewhere like states, but not states, right? So tribes don't have representation on their own, obviously within Congress, but also for the most part, state law does not apply on tribal land, with like a bunch of exceptions that make my job as an Indian law professor like very fun and complicated to teach. For the most part, tribes are, especially over their own citizens, given close to complete authority to self-govern. And they even have more independence than the states do when it comes to that self-governing relationship, because they're not actually bound by the federal constitution, because the federal constitution has been applied to the states through the 14th Amendment, but not to the tribes. So tribes have more freedom and flexibility to structure themselves in different ways. And also because tribes sort of exist in this particular space within the United States government system, they have also kind of been through very tumultuous legal history. I think that's led to two really important insights and innovations. The first is that tribal governments have, as self-governing entities, had to really come up with some clever things and really innovate in order to problem solve some tricky situations created by their colonial experience. When I was working on a paper recently, I was trying to come up with a metaphor for this. And I, at some point, was thinking about, oh, it's the pressure of colonialism. And then there are diamonds that come out sometimes. And then I thought that was too cheesy and I'm too actually, professional law professor to like that, do a metaphor. But it works really well. An example of this that I like to talk about is the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. I'm gonna pull this up actually, because I believe I have the power to share screen. So the Citizen Potawatomi Nation has been through a lot. And after being basically moved a couple times, and then also breaking off with another nation and agreeing to accept U.S. citizenship and also get a different pot of land within Oklahoma, they found themselves with this land base in Oklahoma and this constitution that basically like didn't work for them. So a lot of different tribes or I would say 180, actually, I know exactly, 181 tribes ended up with these constitutions that we refer to as IRA constitutions. It stands for the Indian Reorganization Act. And what had happened is that to make some ugly colonial history short, there had been long periods of Indian wars, putting in Native people on reservations, and then government policies that went up and down with sort of, okay, let's try to have this program that will support tribes, or this treaty that will support, you know, what this tribe might be wanting to do, or actually maybe this is a terrible idea. Like, let's just kind of try to force assimilation of the tribes or break up their land through various policies. So it was very sporadic throughout history. But then in 1934, the person who was in charge of the Bureau of Indian Affairs at the time actually said, one of the things that might solidify the power of tribal governments would actually be if they enacted constitutions that looked, you know, legitimate, frankly, in the eyes of the federal government. And that would also sort of create the stability, integrate them better, et cetera, et cetera. But that they would also play their, you know, some role in drafting and adopting these constitutions themselves. There's like a lot of historical debate about whether there was a model constitution that was circulated around or not, and what that looked like. But most of the tribes ended up with these constitutions that look very much like the US Constitution, as like as if that were a starting block, and then with variations on that that are somewhat different, but not totally. And so I personally think there's definitely a model, and there was definitely also pressure to do that, because it just explains the uniformity of what was adopted across all of these tribes. And so what happened after that is that a lot of these tribal communities found that this document didn't work for them. This constitution was not working for them, because they, you know, it wasn't theirs. It wasn't an organic thing that grew out of their community, and was something that they had real ownership over, but in fact, something that they adopted as sort of part of this colonial process. So a lot of tribes have gone through this process of changing those constitutions. And so the Citizen Potawatomi Nation is one of those tribes that had an Indian Reorganization Act constitution. And it was really not working for them, particularly because they are a tribe in Oklahoma with a small-ish land base, but then that it had a lot of people move outside of the state. Let me pull this up. They'd had a lot of people move out of the state. And as a result of that, they have citizens all across the country, just like, you know, many of you live all across the country. But you can see how that would be kind of a problem. You have people who are tribal citizens who now live very far away from Oklahoma. And yet, actually, the way that their election process was structured, it required people to be not only physically present, but like for there to be a quorum in a room for a lot of various business meetings to be conducted. So everything would just, as the tribal council chair described, just descend into chaos all of the time, because there would be these various ploys to try and get certain of the people who are around town to just show up at these meetings and take them over, and then they turn into fights. And, you know, so that's just not workable, because it was designed for citizen Potawatomi people that were very locally based at the time that the document was drafted, and could all show up, which is not who they were now. And so what they did and said was decide to reform the entire constitution, and make a new set of rules for how they would elect representatives. One of the things that I like to highlight when talking about this is also the process that they engaged with. So they didn't just sort of like have a task force or a commission, like have these scholars together and get together and say, oh, like this is what we should do, according to all smart people. What they did was they had meetings throughout the country with their citizens. Because at this point, two-thirds of the citizen Potawatomi citizens lived outside of the state of Oklahoma. So they had meetings with a lot of these folks scattered all across the country. As their chairman would say, like, we realize that food, if you have food at the meetings, people will come, right? and ask them, like, you know, why aren't you voting in elections? Like, what would make you engage more with what's going on with the tribe? And they realized is people just didn't feel like the elections had anything to do with them. Like that it was about what was going on Potawatomi land, back in Oklahoma, and not about them as Potawatomi citizens across the country. And so this sense of the Potawatomi Nation, citizen Potawatomi Nation, as something that included them and their experience as people who lived no longer on Potawatomi land was not a part of the contemporary identity of that government. And so what they did was sit down and think, okay, how do we fix that? How do we fix that problem? And so they came up with the solution, which was to completely change the way that they would elect members of their legislative body. And this map I'm going to show you is like one of my favorite things. let me get rid of this part. Okay. There we go. All right. Can you all see that? Right. So this is a map of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation legislative districts today, after they redistricted this again in 2017, but after they went through this constitutional reform process in 2007. So remember, this is a tiny reservation in Oklahoma, and they have representatives who are elected to represent, you know, all the citizen Potawatomi Nation citizens who live in the South, all the citizen Potawatomi citizens who live in the, it looks like the Midwest and the Northeast, you know, that's District 1, right? Like this, the first time I saw this map, it kind of blew my mind. I was like, what is this? But you know, the more I looked at it, the more I realized this is a district map that starts with the citizens and what would get them engaged, and then designs itself. And that's brilliant, right? Like that's a diamond that comes out of pressure of trying to get your people to show up and vote. When the pressures of colonialism and diaspora, et cetera, and economic opportunities and government relocation programs have pushed two-thirds of your members off of the traditional homelands. So what I take away from things like this is to, you know, and this is my takeaway one, is to, you know, think, you know, tribes have been forced to think and act in ways that are truly like getting at the root problems, and able to think structurally and act structurally, in ways that I think reveal some of the ways that maybe states and the federal government have instead been thinking in very limited ways about what's possible or what we can do. So that's takeaway one. Takeaway two is that tribes have also gone through a tremendous amount of change. You know, tribal governments, you know, I talked a little bit about the Indian Organization Act and all of those constitutions that came about. But, you know, there were government structures in place before that. There have been revisions to those constitutions. There are hundreds of tribes that didn't enact Indian Reorganization Act constitutions, you know, whether it's written or not. There are all of these different government structures that are in place to, you know, across Indian country that are working for all of these 500 plus communities. And when I, you know, sit down and look at the history of a lot of them, or, you know, pull up a basic governing document like a constitution, you'll see a lot of change over time, over the same time period as the United States has been in existence. And I think, you know, that change has been very, you know, sometimes necessary, sometimes, you know, a reaction, sometimes it's been imposed, right? But there's this other way of thinking about change that I think is really insightful and helpful. So there's some scholarship about change in Indian country and also the structure of different governments that really focuses on these moments of government reform that take place in tribal communities as things that happen once the community is realizing that there isn't a match between who they are, you know, as a people, as a culture, as a, you know, group of people that live in a, you know, various places, like the Potawatomi example. And so, you know, there isn't a match between who they are now and what that government, what that governing document is designed for. And sometimes that's because it was never designed for them in the first place, right? But sometimes it's because people change, a people change. And sometimes the people change and then, or the circumstances change. And so then the, you know, things about the government structure need to change in order to fit that. But one of the things that I think is very common in the United States, when we're thinking about change, structural change to the federal government or state constitution, et cetera, is resistance to change. I think both because we have a cultural narrative that, like, the original document of the US Constitution was like the most brilliant, perfect thing. And so, you know, like, so like there is this kind of faux pas about questioning that or revising it. But also, because I think there is also this fear of change and what that might be like. In law, we talk about a certain type of rhetorical device that various judges or, you know, in debate might come up as the parade of horribles, right? So it's like, well, we can't do this because if we do this one thing, if we take this one step, there'll be this parade, you know, like it'll go, like you can't do one thing because everything else will follow. I think that is sort of how we think about change, and what it would be like to reform systems to, you know, revisit some of the fundamental questions about like how we structure representation, how we run elections, like things like that. It's like, what if we do one thing, the whole thing will fall down, and then who are we? But Native people have had to figure out change and yet a way to preserve who we are. And by asking a bunch of really important questions about constantly sort of, okay, who are we now? What makes us ourselves? And, you know, I like to think of this one, people talk about your ancestors all the time, right? Like in your connection to them and how much that is also a part of identity, right? And so I like to think, you know, like, you know, as a Native person, someone that my grandma would recognize? You know, and so is there that core continuity between those things that matter, such that we would know each other as a way of sort of keeping that continuity of basic important ideals and spirit. And I think those are really important lenses for thinking about change because they allow you to do it in a way that is intentional and reflective, but also just incredibly careful. And I think, you know, as people who've gone through various changes, many of which have been forced on us and very destructive, having a way of thinking about change that is that careful, you know, makes perfect sense. You know, we want to be very protective and not lose anything else of what we currently have because it is so precious. And so I would hope that, you know, in this time, which is very tumultuous, but also that I think has forced us to do a lot of questioning and thinking about some of the really fundamental things within American government, American society, and the structure underlying it all, that we would also be able to ask those kinds of careful questions and have those also be part of the guiding work that we do as we're pushing for various, you know, reforms, both within the system, but maybe also to the system itself. So with that, I will sort of end my prepared remarks, and I really look forward to all your questions.
Thank you. I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative and ask if the restructuring then of the Potawatomi tribe and the redistricting, did it work to increase their engagement? Or
yes, it did. Yeah, no, voter turnout doubled and has pretty much stayed steady at that doubled rate since then.
Oh, wonderful.
With a couple strange dips for years when people ran unopposed. But
okay. We had a question. This is, what is the preferred way to refer to Native people, Native American, American Indian, Indigenous, or other?
Yeah, so great question. So this is a great question that's complicated. And people have different opinions about this. Native scholars have different opinions about this. I use Native American, American Indian, and Indian pretty interchangeably, both because I, you know, hear them all the time and was raised around them interchangeably. But also as kind of a way of normalizing that people are going to use them all. So that's what I do. Within the area that I work in, which is the law, everything says Indian. You know, the U.S. Constitution talks about the Indians not taxed, right? So there is, quite literal enshrinement of that word, you know, old and inaccurate such as it is, within the law and the doctrine. And because of that, it is still what people use. And I think that various pushes to stop using that have also had lawyers, raise flags about, we don't want to be too fast and loose with also the words that were used to make the promise. If, we sort of say, well, this is who we are now. That's a bit trusting. I would say to always just ask people what they prefer, as between those various terms. But really, when it comes to those terms, be really careful when you're using them in the first place, because think about how limited they are and what they really mean or don't mean. So, my office thinks I've disappeared. there we go. I suppose a native person of New Spain and then of Mexico before being a Native American, because of the history of the United States, or because of the history of New Mexico and its indigenous peoples. And so the category of Native American versus First Nations in Canada versus the indigenous people of Mexico, it's the difference between that is a bunch of artificial borders anyway. Race construction such as it is a thing, and plays out for Native people in a very real way in the way that it does, and how we're treated. But the identities that have a real meaning, it's not Indian, it's not our Native identity, it's not that I would have that much in common with people from Alaska or across an entire continent in New York. They have very different cultures. I mean, some similarities, I'm sure, just like European cultures have some similarities, but not this big important identity the same way that my Nambe Pueblo tribal identity is a big important identity that has people and history and language and food and culture and places and ceremonies and building materials and all of these other things that are more real. So I would say always try to use a tribal identity first. And then after that, it totally depends on the person. For me, I use all three interchangeably.
Thank you. We have another question from Susan Parks. In Maine, there are four tribes. One of them, the Aroostook Band of CMAX has not been identified by the federal government. So what criteria does the federal government use to determine whether a tribe obtains federal status?
That's a very tricky and hard question. The criteria that the federal government uses is long and complicated and involves consulting historians and essentially they are trying to figure out via historical records what sort of proof they have that this group of peoples like is a tribe still. And was a tribe prior to contact. And what is hard about that is that the standards for what counts as like evidence of that is completely set by both, you know, a Western system in the first place. So, you know, written records are great. Oral history is not so great comparatively. But also that for some tribes, there has been this perverse trick of history a bit where if you made a lot of deals with the US, there's a lot more records. But if you just fought them or anything to do with them, there's not a paper trail in the same way. And so it, you know, so then you show up now and say, you know, we have been here this whole time doing this. And they're like, well, I'll prove it. and that's been a fight that a lot of tribes have been fighting for recognition. And it takes decades and decades for some of them. What I will say on that too, though, is that it is, it's part, you know, this is part of the colonial history still, I think, is that, and that people, I think quite rightly question, is that the federal government is still the one deciding what a tribe is and who counts as a tribe. What process would be there instead? Could tribes recognize each other? That would be a complicated process as well, because Indian politics are like other politics, which is they can be messy. Tribes don't always agree. They have different incentives. To answer your question, that's the basic inquiry.
Okay, thank you. We have a question from Michelle Garrick-Nave. In light of the U.S. government's actions in South Dakota regarding the oil pipeline, it appears that the government, federal government, is still disregarding Native American rights. Do you agree with this? How true is that?
Yeah, so there are a lot of complicated things that are happening with the fights over pipelines. Part of that, I think, is much like with a lot of the history of protest in this country, a demonstration that when, you know, oppressed minority groups and people of color especially exercise certain rights, there can be a double standard in terms of the response of violence and force that they are met with. That illustrates the different value of people's lives and bodies and voices in this country, which is itself, unsurprising, un-new and horrifying. Always. So there's that. But I think there's also this, then there's also this other layer to it, which is the role of tribal governments themselves in this. And for a very long time, the federal government has done all kinds of stuff to lands, to Native people, to Native traditional lands, and not cared at all what impact that would have. One of the things, I'm teaching a thing on the taking of Native lands next week, and one of the things that I get to teach, which always is just horrible, is that, you know, we learn that under Fifth Amendment, the government can't take anything from you without just compensation, right? Well, not if you're an Indian. You know, they could take Indian land and the Aboriginal title that we have is not something that they owe us anything for. And similarly, when there's if Congress makes a promise in a treaty and then it changes its mind about it, that's a matter for Congress. That's a political question. There's nothing that courts can do to intervene and make them pay for breaking those promises. So there's a lot of federal government doing all kinds of terrible things and not having to pay for it, not having to care, and not having any kind of accountability for it. With recent decades, there has been improvement in that the federal government has developed this robust process, which it calls consultation, where in a wide range of issues that implicate Indian interests or tribal lands, they will consult with the relevant tribes. But just how meaningful that is, what it looks like, how much they're really listening, or frankly, if there's any actual power, exchange happening, is questionable. And so I think with things like these pipelines, we're really seeing the limits of consultation. It's like sometimes it doesn't happen. And when it doesn't happen, Native people can rightly be very upset about that failure. But that, you know, even if it does happen, is that just a rubber stamp? And saying, oh, well, we did something. And so what would it look like to have something different? Because, you know, Native people don't own a lot of these lands that are still very sacred to them or still important to them or still have huge impacts on their territory because of, you know, they're upstream or because of these interconnected ecosystems. And so giving tribal governments actual power over these decisions that are going to impact their lives, you know, that goes back to my, you know, part of the things I was saying earlier in my talk is, you know, that takes structural thinking. You know, what would actually give these tribal governments a real say, a real, whether it's veto power or, you know, power within other representative systems to be able to actually prevent these types of harms. Because a system that requires, I think, the question that you're asking, which is how much does this colonial power care about us? If that's not us, if really fundamental things about health and survival require this constant job of like convincing people in power to care about me and people who look like me, like that is not a system that is set up for us to survive. That is a system set up for the, you know, whims to come and go and us to come and go. And so I'm hopeful that there could be better systems.
Okay, so thank you. We had a comment in terms of the identity and terminology, just by Christopher Linetto. She's on our League of Women Voters Santa Fe County, and she notes that we have the Institute of American Indian Arts and the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture in Santa Fe, and there's the Smithsonian Museum of the American Indian, and both had all had significant tribal involvement in their creation and development. So that just speaks to that, and I'm asking what you'd like to be called, I guess, how you'd like to be referred to. We have a question from Julie Williams Hill. What would help the federal government bridge the horrible injustices done to tribes? Reparations, land return, an apology? Question mark.
I think I probably alluded to this, but like, I'm interested. I think probably like real power, like real representation. I think, you know, it is really, really maddening that, you know, tribal governments collectively, you know, there's 574 of them, which is, you know, just itself, that's a huge number, right? Like 50 states, there's 574 tribal governments in this country. And together, they, you know, there are 21 tribes that control, that have larger reservations, that control more land than the smallest state, right? So there's 21 tribal governments in this, of those 574, that are dealing with a land base that is larger than, you know, an entity that gets two senators. and the largest one of them, the Navajo Nation, like they're, like if they were on this, a map of the United States, go look it up. It's massive. They're huge. They control a huge amount of territory, like basically a quarter of Arizona. And collectively, all of that land is about as much as California, right? That's huge. It's a huge amount of the United States. We're a small amount of the population, but, you know, a huge part of rural America has a lot of states and not that much population as well, and a huge amount of voice and power in government. And that's not true for us. And I think that's because we were never planned for, you know, like the early Supreme Court cases dealing with Native people and even establishing that tribal sovereignty persisted and was going to be recognized also made very clear this was on a timeline. You know, no one expected them to survive. They would be integrated and assimilated, and this wouldn't be a problem for very long, right? So like the fact that we have survived has both defied expectations and created a structural problem within the United States that many, many people just don't see, because we have all of these, you know, governing problems, governing responsibilities, and yet all of the decisions about, you know, a lot of the most fundamentally important things are made by people who don't necessarily always understand that reality. You know, there will be a case about, you know, it's likely going to go to the Supreme Court very soon about the Indian Child Welfare Act, and it implicates like 85 questions in constitutional law and Indian law. And one of the things that it kind of raises is this sort of fundamental question of like, who is an Indian? What are Indians? Are you a race? Are you political groups? How should we deal with all these different laws that treat you as separate people? You know, currently under the law, we're not treated as a race. And so it doesn't trigger strict scrutiny under constitutional doctrine. But really, it sort of lives in this bubble where Congress has almost unlimited power over Indian affairs. And often the court will either throw up its hands or get involved in ways that it probably ought to, not to. But either way, what just makes me totally nuts is that I'm sitting here trying to decide whether the Supreme Court or Congress should be answering that question instead of tribes, there are a bunch of organized governments that could play a role in a more robust way somewhere in this country. But this was unplanned for, so they're just here and forced to basically lobby Congress like any other entity, except they have to lobby them for both a basic understanding of who they are and what their challenges are and what their communities want, and then also like, please, basic funding for things. And then also, can we have workable rules, like laws, about how we can govern this territory, please? So that's why I'm interested in not relying on that dynamic forever. So.
Okay. There's a question: how has the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision about Oklahoma been received by the tribes there, and what actions are they taking? Do you know the answer to that question?
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know, a couple summers ago, in McGirt versus Oklahoma, the Supreme Court decided that about half of Oklahoma is actually within the boundaries, the Supreme Court did not technically decide that half of Oklahoma is within the boundaries of an Indian reservation, because I am a lawyer who is very precise about technicalities. This is an important distinction. What they decided was that treaties and subsequent history had both promised this area of eastern Oklahoma to five tribes in Oklahoma. And then when examining it for one of those tribes, the Muscogee Creek Nation, they held that Congress had never appropriately disestablished their claim to that land as their reservation. And so because the same history and treaty language applies to the other four tribes, it's likely that whole massive swath of territory in eastern Oklahoma, even though the actual decision that went to the Supreme Court was only about one of those tribes. So the reason that that little tangent was important is that what's going on in Oklahoma is a lot of sort of political chaos and negotiating, because the state obviously was not happy about this decision, but also created some problems for itself, because part of their litigation strategy was to make it seem like it would be a disaster, right? If the tribes claim to this territory was upheld. But what it you know, in actuality means is, you know, it says it changes nothing about property rights. Land that is owned within this territory by non-Indian persons, which is the vast, vast, vast majority of land, is still owned by non-Indian persons. And most of the conduct that happens there, which tends to be non-Indian conduct, and non-Indian conduct that relates to other non-Indians or doesn't relate to tribal affairs too intensely, all of that still would be governed by the state and by state law. But part of that litigation strategy to make it seem like, oh, this would be a disaster, like, how could we deal with this, was to not downplay that that reality of things will mostly just stay the same was going to be how things would go. So there was both this immediate chaos after the decision, and then a lot of negotiating in rooms, I think, that it seems like have fallen apart, where the state, I think, just very much wants Congress to fix this. You know, like I explained earlier, Congress can just say, like, never mind. Let's just extinguish these reservation boundaries and make it just Oklahoma again. But they need the political pressure and will to do that. So the state would like that. The state of Oklahoma would like that. The tribes would not like that. They would, you know, they're very happy about this increased authority and want to exercise it, but also are willing to work with the state and willing to probably, my sense is, are trying to figure out the boundaries of what authorities they'd be willing to allow the state to exert in exchange for various things, and like vice versa, to come up with something that works for both of them. But, you know, just like, you know, we see all the time in Congress, like negotiations over really important things only work, I think, when you're doing that in really good faith. And it seems like the state still sort of hoping they just won't have to do this. So every time I check in on it, it seems like there's just more political turmoil and things are still at a bit of a standoff.
Okay, from a Rebecca Alvarez in Santa Fe County, League of Women Voters in the state, what would real power and representation mean in terms of tribal sovereignty in the realm of education?
Well, so I think that there's... Oh, there's different things to that. So on the sovereignty point, I think, okay, so I'll answer this twofold. One, I think in schools just generally, there is this still mass ignorance and erasure about the existence of contemporary Native people and tribal governments as real people and real governments. sometimes I do this exercise where it's like, name, you know, as many tribes as you can, or like name as many Indians as you can. And then if with the name as many Indians as you can, it's like, okay, cross off all the dead ones, you know, like, and then people are like, ugh. I think just trying to end that and then bring contemporary Native stories into classrooms, bringing contemporary Native history and law and activism, all of that stuff into classrooms is great. Because, you know, it's the invisibility and the idea that we're just like stuck in this past that I think has done a tremendous amount of harm, because it seeps into the law, and it seeps into other aspects of life all of the time, in ways that are truly, truly harmful. So I think that, you know, that's important. But then the other thing, which is, I think tribes can also do really exciting work with education and like running their own school systems. Some do in a cooperative way, which is really great. Because they can, you know, often run facilities that are really important centers for, you know, empowering Native kids with their culture, or also doing really active work to preserve that, which is, you know, the opposite of how education has been for Native people. Traditionally, you know, boarding schools were such a horrific period of harm for Native people and Native culture, where the government took away so many kids and, you know, tried to, as the slogan was, kill the Indian, save man. One of the stories that I just absolutely love is with the schools, the immersion schools in Hawaii, which started off as basically a way to introduce immersion to a new generation of Native Hawaiian youth, so that they would grow up learning their language, because they would hear it at school and they would require all the teachers to speak it. And it's just had a tremendous impact in that community in terms of language preservation, and not just for the kids, but, you know, for their parents and for the community, and et cetera. And, you know, it's something that's hard and probably expensive to make happen, but we're, you know, language loss is such a huge problem for so many tribal communities. I think taking ownership and creating something like that is an inspiring option.
Okay, I'm just going to say we have about 10 minutes left. So one question from Susan Haas: any suggestions for improving the flow of information across cultural boundaries for better understanding?
Yeah, I think it takes a lot of humility. And I think it takes putting yourself actually in situations that are uncomfortable. I think American culture, I would venture to say also parts of white American culture, really value comfort and fear being uncomfortable. You know, like the idea that you may be, for example, like the only person of your race or of your class in a room. It's just like, sometimes I make people just like feel uncomfortable. Like, yeah. And yeah, I think it's just like, so what? Like, you know, it's like, that's like, discomfort is a very, like the fear of discomfort is such a like construct thing that has such an outsized import on us, and also our behavior to, I think, make us avoid each other. And I think you put your foot in your mouth and again, feel like, oh no, the world's gonna fall apart. No, like just have grace for yourself, for other people. Like, don't walk away from a situation where you even made a, you know, what seems like a mistake or said something ignorant and feel like, oh gosh, what a disaster. I don't want to do that again. It was too awful. You know, that's that's just making so much of that about both you and also being like this weird, like perfect person who doesn't actually need to learn anything or can't get things wrong. You know, I've totally done this myself too. I you know, when I was at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, I was also, you know, I took that job because I wanted to do amazing racial justice, voting rights work in particular. But I also realized that I was going to be put in a situation where I was a cultural outsider amongst a bunch of racial minority communities that I didn't know. And that was a very, you know, challenging and humbling experience for me. You know, I was I've had no experience with Black communities in the Deep South before that. And then I had, you know, clients, and also, you know, not just individual clients who were welcoming me into their home and telling me some of the hardest parts of their lives, but also, some of my clients were families who were representative of a community of families who were in a school district. And who am I, this lawyer showing up saying, "Hi, I represent a class action of the Black families in this school district. This is my first time here." I'm like, it's lovely. Where should I get dinner? But also, like, we're going to have a community meeting. Tell me what, like, you think we should do about schools. You know, like, what? And it's totally humbling, and hard. And, you know, realizing that poverty in the Black Belt in Alabama is different than reservation poverty that I'm used to was also real. And, you know, navigating cultural spaces and eating out at, you know, different types of restaurants and things, that was, you know, it wasn't comfortable, but I am so glad I did it. You know, I learned so much, and I wouldn't trade that on all of the learning of that discomfort or anything.
Okay, we have time, a little bit of time here. Marilyn Doolin of the Los Alamos chapter of the League of Women Voters asks, how accessible are the many scholarships and higher education opportunities to tribal students in New Mexico, and what more could be done?
Yeah. So I think that there are Native kids who are, you know, brilliant and who would do so well in, you know, various amazing institutions across this country of higher education. But I think there's really two things that make their success possible. And one is they need to know about these institutions, and which, you know, like a lot of the networks that, like, where you learn about things like Ivy League schools, and like also, but frankly, also how to apply to them and like build that application is not something that a lot of Native people necessarily have. So, you know, I am where I am because of this program called College Horizons, which is fantastic, and takes a bunch of Native kids from across the country and basically does this crash course summer camp type thing for them for a week, where different college admissions officers from universities across the country, you know, who benefit from it too, because they can recruit, and then other college counselors help us come together and write our personal statements. And, you know, we leave with SAT prep books, and we meet all these admissions officers who get to know us and help us figure out what's important to us, building a list of colleges and thinking about, you know, where we might actually thrive. So I think that like access bridge is just key. And for me, it was that program where people told me that I could go to a school like Yale. Because before that, I didn't really know like where I could go or fit. I had no idea. And then I just felt so believed in. And also surrounded by other Native kids who were doing the same thing with their own college journeys, wherever that was. So College Rising is great. You can donate to it if you want. It's run actually by folks in New Mexico, luckily. So that's also great. But I think the other thing is that Native people are a small population and a lot of times just need a cluster and community of each other in order to survive in institutions of higher education, right? Like even in this job, you know, I just went through this process of getting hired at Stanford. And during that process, I was interviewing at a bunch of other schools across the country. And for a lot of them, one of my questions was, am I going to be the only Indian in town? You know, am I like, what is it going to be like for me and my family to live there? And the same thing is happening to kids who are going off to different colleges across the country, right? And so a lot of times the college itself is the place that provides a Native community such as it is in the other students that are there. So there are these important clusters of Native students that develop at certain schools that have invested more in their Native community and in supporting them with cultural houses, with academic support staff, with faculty, right? And I think supporting those bubbles, especially, and making them strong and getting students to them so that they can really survive there instead of going to a place where they realize, oh, I am living this strange life where I am the only Indian in the world. Can I do this for 4 years? Like, is not a question that is not something that they're dealing with. So, you know, I'm lucky Stanford is one of these bubbles. I love, you know, I just went to an orientation with 30 incoming Native freshmen. There were out of the 109, I think, freshmen that Stanford admitted this year and that are coming. So, you know, that's really exciting.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth. Yeah. I want to respect your time. And I this has been phenomenal. The feedback we're getting is that it's been very, very interesting, learned a lot. We had a couple of other really good questions we couldn't get to, but I thank everybody for coming and asking their questions and participating, and Elizabeth for an insightful, informational presentation. So thanks so much.
Bye-bye,
everybody. You.